Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. So a couple of things. One is I want to get the project going. So today in the class, if you could hand me your sheet of the preferences for your topics of interest, give me 3 or 5 of them. One being the one you most prefer to do. And if you haven't thought about it and want to think about it and give it to me later today, that's fine. Slide under my door tomorrow morning. I hope you come in and just take those and start sorting through them and try to sort of load level the various presentations and give you things of interest. Okay with that? All right, and then we'll talk about where we go from there once we got through. The other thing is exam one is graded. I have them up here. There is one that has no name, so if you go searching for your exam and can't find it, you should come up and we'll discuss whether or not the one I have is yours. Hopefully it will be. If 2 of you come, then we've got a problem. You guys did well. The grades are up on Blackboard. I'll hand these back to you at the end of class. I will post the solutions I haven't done yet because I hadn't connected with Mayor until just a few minutes before class. I wanted to make sure that we didn't discover a problem in the solution, so we haven't at least yet. So I'll post those. I'll talk about the curve when I hand them back. Remind me with a few minutes left in class today, and we'll go ahead and hand them back to you. But overall, I mean, the class did great. And so what you'll want to do is to look at how you did on each problem, check for grading errors. It happens. The way that we handle regrades or whatever is, if you, first of all, I don't even want to hear about it until you've looked at it and you've looked at the solution and you're pretty sure you understand the solution, and then you look at what you've done and you can argue whether or not it's perfect. At that point, I'm very happy to hear from you, okay? But prior to that, don't bother me with it, because all I'm going to do is say, go make sure you understand the solution and then come make an argument. So basically, though, in many instances, when there is a needed regrade, it's sort of obvious. And so all I really want you to do is to write what you want me to look at on the front of your exam and hand it back to me or slip it under my door. I'll wait a few days, collect the handful that come in, and then I'll look at them, and I'll let you know when I'm done with that, if there's something needed. So if you don't look over your exam carefully and the solutions carefully and check the grading, I don't know how to say this nicely. You're an idiot. Do that. First of all, it's a learning experience. Second of all, mistakes actually do happen. Not all the time, so I think the grading is probably fine for almost everything, but there are, in every exam, there are a few things, and so you should always check. Okay, so any questions of that? So we'll look at the curve so that you can get a sense of how I think you're doing on that test. If you sense that something didn't work as well as you would like, I don't have a sense that this was a bad exam, okay? It was maybe, I mean, you guys did pretty well. Mean was around 78, which is high for me, so good for you. I didn't think it was an easy test going in, so that's good. If your grade isn't what you want it to be, the thing to do is to think about how you're approaching the class, and now would be the time to fix it. I'll tell you what I run into sometimes, probably less so in this class than in some others. We do have, was it 2 exams plus a final, and you can drop it. If things didn't go so well on this exam, you need to think about what's gone well, what's not, and try to understand why maybe didn't make adjustments now. It's very typical, for example, in 113 and 114, where I have 3 exams and a final, for students to sort of just make some excuses about why they didn't do so well on the first exam. Oh, I was a little bit tired, or, you know, I was whatever. And they don't really change anything. And then comes exam two, and they get creamy. And then they come, they're panicked. But then a lot of water is on the bridge. So we can make adjustments, which is a lot harder at that point. So you want to make adjustments now if you think you need to. I mean, sometimes... And one of the reasons I have a drop is sometimes you do have a bad day. Sometimes you didn't get a good night's sleep, so you just want to make sure you do the next time or whatever. But if there's adjustments we can do on the studying, then we should. I did have... it's a big class, and some of them are pretty intense about their grades. So one of the things I found was that when students were having issues with their grades, they would come and ask me, and we go through the exam. And I found I was saying a lot of the same sort of diagnostics, or asking a lot of the same diagnostic questions with students. And so I actually made a little troubleshooting guide, and I don't know if I've linked it to your website yet, but I will. And it is a little bit 113, 114 design, so it's not quite as relevant for you guys. But if you would like to do better, if you go through the troubleshooting guide and give you some things to think about in terms of how you're studying, that can help. I don't think it's as relevant for you guys, but you may find that useful. But certainly, it's also true that there aren't 200 of you, so I'm happy to chat with any of you who wants to sit down. If you do, it's very helpful to me in diagnostic if we actually need to bring your exam to me, and then we sit and look through your exam together. Often, when I do that, I can get a sense of what's going well and what's not. So, okay, so I'll hand the exam back at the end of class. Somebody reminds me. So we were doing relativity. I hope I convinced you it's pretty weird stuff. All that we talked about last time was special relativity. Special means that you are relating measurements that are made between two reference frames that are moving at constant velocity respect to one another. Many years later, about 11 years later or so, Einstein published work where he considered accelerating reference frames, which is known as the theory of general relativity. The special relativity...
I think I have a picture of it here. No.
If you read German, it's on the electrodynamics of moving bodies, basically. And that was the title for the paper on special relativity. So it didn't really say, you know, weirdness with space and time or something like, or how to travel to the future. It was on the electrodynamics of moving bodies. So later this class, we'll start next, we'll talk about why he was talking about electrodynamics, which is the reason why we're doing relativity right now, because I basically want to introduce magnetism through relativity. So, all right.
So that was his paper on special relativity. Then he did the general relativism paper. And you may wonder, okay, wait a minute, general relativity is gravity, and you're talking accelerated reference frames. And I think that
every time you get on an elevator and press the button, you should understand why he's doing this, right? Because if you are in an accelerated reference frame, you feel the acceleration on you is equivalent to sort of feeling gravity. Okay? And so in typical Einsteinian fashion, he took something everyone sees and knows every day and took it very seriously and then followed it all the way to the end. So he actually formulated something called the equivalence principle, which is an accelerated reference frame is equivalent to a gravitational field. Which may sound really strange, but he just asks the stupid question. I'm in an elevator, and it starts accelerating, and if I have no windows, how can I tell that I'm not just out, you know, that somehow a gravitational field around me hasn't just increased? And the equivalence principle tells you you can't tell. So what he says is that you could be in a box at the surface of the Earth feeling the 1G pull toward the surface, Or you could be in a spaceship in the same box, but the spaceship is accelerated at 1g, and the equivalence principle says you cannot distinguish between these two things. Which is a bit of a leap, actually. Not obvious that there has to be a real connection there. But if you now pursue this,
what are the kinds of things you run into? Let's imagine that you are in your rocket ship and you have a little trusty light gun or something, and you shoot a pulse of light toward the wall.
So you shoot it directly toward the wall, 90 degrees. As the light travels, because it travels at a finite speed, the rocket ship and you in the box basically accelerates upward around the light as the light moves transversely toward the wall. And since it's accelerating, in fact, what you'll see if you were to trace out the pulse of light from your point of view in the elevator, it would look like this. That the curvature would be actually changing a little bit because you're accelerating. You okay with that? So if, in fact, you're going fast enough and the acceleration was big enough, then the path of the light would take would appear to be curved. Okay. Now, if you believe in the equivalence principle, then that means that if you are in a gravitational field, the light travels in on a curved path. And that's a little different from what you're used to thinking, which is light travels the shortest distance between two points. Although you can say that that's still true, but that what happens is the gravitational field actually distorts the space so that it is traveling on what's called a geodesic. It's traveling on the shortest distance between two points, but that the gravitational field effectively is distorting the geometry of the space-time. Quite a leap. So then why it took 11 years to do this was because that took me into the realm of curved geometries. Differential geometry in mathematics is very nasty. So in special relativity, we saw that there is no absolute nature to space and time, and that they get all mixed up, and a whole lot depends on this point of view. Now you're thinking of them as a fabric, in a sense, that gets distorted depending on the energy and mass that's in the region of space. And the mathematics of general relativity, then, is based on curved geometries because you literally have to quantify this distortion. And so that's why general relativity is substantially harder than special relativity in terms of its
mathematics. So it's a different world. So now, if you were to simplify space into sort of a two-dimensional-like thing, you can argue that gravitating bodies quite literally just distort the space-time, and it is that which effectively conveys the force.
That's a very different picture from sort of the Newtonian field, instant force at a distance sort of thing. And it has serious implications, because if I now take this mass and I wiggle it, or I have two masses that are rotating and collapse into one, it's going to change the nature of this distortion, and that's going to propagate out in space and time in the way that you would if, water waves on a pond surface. Those are called gravity waves. And so they're very specific predictions. It also means that if a mass just suddenly appeared, a black hole suddenly appeared where Jupiter is, it actually takes time for that to propagate to us. Right. So it's a fairly different mental picture of the nature of the force.
So, and it
turns out to agree with experiment. Gravity is enormously weak, so to look for gravitational effects on many things is very difficult because you have to eliminate all the other forces of nature and sense in your observations. But in addition, in order to really test general relativity, I mean, at least one thing you want to do is to look for deviations from Newtonian gravity. And those deviations are often fairly small or very hard to measure because you would want to see some really big mass or something like that. So one of the first measurements happened, I recall it was about 9 years or so after the paper came out, where it was observed that the sun bends light to an extent that agrees with general relativity. So during an eclipse, astronomers looked at the position of a particular light, a star, which they know where it is typically, and then they wanted to look at the position of it when the light passed close to the sun, which they could do during an eclipse. And what they found was the apparent position of the star appeared to be very different from what it would be without the sun there. So the star was known to be over here, but when they took the photographs, they found that it looked like it was over here. So it got shifted due to the curvature of the light around the sun. This has now gone from something which is used to test general relativity to a very fundamental and important tool in astronomy, where quite literally you can probe large things in the universe at large distances by looking at how the light is bent as it goes around the object. It's called gravitational lensing. And it's here's an example of a gravitationally lensed object.
People have can use that to probe the density of dark objects in the universe, and you can use it to actually look at mass distributions and stuff. It's actually one of the tools people have used to study dark matter in astrophysical situations. Because basically, they can look at an astrophysical object and use gravitational lensing to get a map of the distribution of the gravitational mass, and they can compare that to the light map, which would be the map of normal matter. And there's one very particular instance, which is called the bullet cluster, where two galaxies basically collided and went through each other. And what happens is the dark matter really doesn't interact with anything very readily. So the dark matter map looks like this, but the normal matter map is sort of like this, because the normal matter interacts, and so it doesn't move through the other matter so quickly. There's a lot of interaction. So what they found is this sort of separation of dark matter and the normal matter. And this is, I have the plot, I didn't think to bring it to show it to you. It's a strong piece of anecdotal evidence for the existence of dark matter. So it's an important astrophysical tool. There are other things it predicts that people have observed. This was one of the first things observed. One important thing also happens is that you've heard of the Doppler shift for sound, right? The car goes zipping by, it's right? You have the high pitch, low pitch thing coming toward you, away from you. You also have the optical red shift or blue shift, which is exactly the same sort of thing, but it's relativistic. For something that's coming toward you, away from you, it's toward you, the light is blue shifted, it's shifted toward the blue higher frequency, away from you, it's a little bit red shifted. There's an effect also that comes from general relativity, and sort of a way to think about it is the light has to fight its way out of the gravitational well to get up to somewhere else, and in doing so it uses some of its energy and basically becomes redshifted. You can also think of it in terms of clocks, because if you're distorting space, you're also distorting time. It turns out that general relativity tells you that if you're in a large gravitational field, your clock will run slower than it does if you're not. So the gravitational field is an accelerated reference frame. So if you're as you change
what gravitational potential you're in, you're changing reference frames. And so if you relate the clock in a reference frame, which is at a low gravitational potential to one that's a high, you'll find that you have a clock shift or also a frequency shift of the light. So if you see light that's emitted from a very heavy object, it will appear to be redshifted relative to you, even if that object is not moving with respect to you. There's another thing which is a little closer to home. Newtonian mechanics, if you look at the orbit of Mercury, and this is highly distorted, but it basically has closest points to the Sun and farthest points to the Sun, and this is called the perihelion. And if you look at how the position of the perihelion rotates around the planet as the planet does its orbit. So if you notice, if you think of this as the path of the planet, you'll notice that with time the perihelion actually also moves. And it turns out the Newtonian mechanics gets that wrong, and relativity gets that right. So relativity, as we also mentioned, predicts these gravitational waves, and there has not yet been a really good measurement of that, or a measurement that I think is not controversial. The issue is that in order to be able to measure this easily, you'd like to have black holes or something, you know, nearby so you can wiggle on and see what happens. That's not so easy to achieve. So it turns out that if you look at typical astrophysical processes and then you look to see how far away they are from us, just like any wave, the intensity falls off as it goes out, right? The energy drops is 1/r². By the time the wave reaches us, it has a really small amplitude. And it might be on the order of something smaller than a nucleus. So this is a very small distortion to measure. It has very much a strange characteristic. Unlike a wave on a string, which just sort of does this, the gravitational wave in space-time, if it's coming toward you and you look at what's happening transversely, it tends to squeeze in one way and go out the other way and then reverse back the other way, sort of a quadrupole distortion in space-time. So that's very characteristic and different from other types of wave-type effects that you may run into. There are devices that have been built out in Hanford, Washington, and Louisiana, which in principle may achieve the sensitivity and be able to see gravity waves soon-ish, but it's a very tough business. So,
any questions or thoughts about general relativity?
I mean, that's all I'm going to say about it. All right, we don't need it for the rest of this class. Okay, I thought it was good to mention it.
So I want to come back to special relativity and pursue that a bit more.
And if you'll forgive me, some of these diagrams are a bit painful to draw in real time. So I'm going to use slides I've prepared in the past for at least a few of these next few slides. So what we've talked about so far is relating, one of the things we talked about was relating time over which something happened in one reference frame relative to another reference frame moving at a fixed velocity with respect to it. You may have already noticed if you had a workshop or if you started in homework problems, when I tell the story, I think it's easy to understand, but the minute you're faced with a real physical situation, sometimes it's not so easy to understand which time gets shifted. So there's a way to think about that. You write down the time in one frame and the time in the other frame, and the way in which you think about how to shift the times is that there's one frame in the universe that's very special for any event, and that is the frame where the event happens at rest. Okay? So if you are in the reference frame of the clock itself, then the time that that clock measures, you say that is the proper frame. Okay? And then if you remember the words time dilation, then just remember that dilation means the time in other frames is longer. So in the proper frame, the time is the shortest. Once you know that, then you know which side of the equation to put the gamma on. Gamma is always greater than 1. So if the time is the shortest, this must be the proper frame. Gamma is greater than 1. And then if you find the time in any other reference frame, it will be bigger than the time is measured in the proper frame. Okay? So that's sort of the trick, how to think your way through those things. All right, so the time is shortest in the proper frame.
If you have a problem set up where you have a link that you have to deal with,
we have link contraction. So in the proper frame, you have the link that you measure. That is the frame where the meter stick is at rest. In that frame, the distance is as long as it's going to ever be. In any other reference frame with respect to that, the distance is shorter. Therefore, if this is the proper frame distance, I divide by gamma to get a number which is smaller. So that's the trick. And of course, that's only along the direction of relative motion. The transverse dimensions do not shift at all. You okay with that? All right, so that's the trick.
Okay, so one of the issues is, I mean, that depending on how the problem is set up, that may be very relevant.
But if you have a problem which is a little bit more real-world-ish, where you may have two events happening separated in space and time, then you can really directly use just the time formula or the distance formula. You have to use the full transformation. So let us look at what happens in the Newtonian world initially, which would be the classical Galilean transformations. So let's imagine that we have one reference frame S with an origin O here, X, Y, Z, and you measure an event that happens at X, Y, Z, and T in that frame of reference. And then we have another reference frame that's moving relative to the initial frame along the X direction. And we say that in this frame of reference, you have X prime, Y prime, and Z prime. And what you'd like to be able to do is to measure an event in either frame and find what its coordinates are in the other frame. Okay, that's what you mean when you talk about these transformations. So classically, let's look at this. Let us imagine that this thing is zipping by. It's moving at velocity V, which means this origin, O prime, in the S frame is going to be at a position V times T, where T is measured in S, right? If you are in S, then you have a position, an event that happens at X, Y, and Z. In S prime, it will happen at Z prime. That distance doesn't change just because you're moving this way. Y prime doesn't change just because you're moving this way. But X prime here is now different from what you see here because the origin is changing with time. So the X coordinate has to be changing. If we say that this is distance D, or X prime, this X prime is going to be equal to the distance X in the S frame minus VT. Okay? Standard stuff. Y prime is equal to Y, Z prime is equal to Z, and the time is the same in both because we have absolute time in Galilean transformation. This is the world in which we grew up, in which we live. Okay? Let's look and see how this changes in relativity.
Well, let me ask you, what breaks in relativity?
How is this going to be different? X prime here is a distance that's measured in S prime. And you're trying to relate it to X, which is measured in S. So you take VT and you want to add that to this, but you can't add it to X prime because X prime is in a different reference frame. So relative to that, it's going to be contracted. So you're going to have to make a change there. The other thing is, if you look at time, the time also gets shifted as you go.
So
in relativity, this x prime is the length that is at rest in s prime. And in order to now add it to the vt to get the distance as seen in s, you then have to do the length contraction. So we'll say that the length contracted quantity is this x prime divided by gamma. All right? So D is going to be equal to X minus VT. And this D is X prime over gamma. So X prime is equal to gamma times X minus VT. So it's now a very different transformation that involves gamma.
If gamma is 1, it's the same as you have in the Galilean transformations. Okay? But if V is very large, a reasonable fraction of the speed of light,
the transformation is really quite different.
That makes sense? You okay with that?
If you want to go the other way, you can start out saying S prime and ask what happens, how do I get the S coordinates, and X front prime is this D prime minus VT prime, but D prime is again going to be Lorentz contracted. D prime would represent this distance as seen in S prime. So you have to relativistically contract the distance x to get the d prime. So you end up basically, so this would be, if you look at it from the prime point of view, it's the same problem, but now the s coordinate system is moving the velocity that way. So when you flip it around, you end up with the same formula, but it's a plus sign there. Which again, if gamma is equal to 1, this would be exactly what you get with Galilean transformation if you were looking at it from the other point of view. So if I take those two transformation formulas and I take this x prime and I substitute it in here, I can do algebra. It's painful enough that I didn't actually want to do it again for you, or it's painful enough I didn't want to bother putting the page up. You can prove it to yourself, though. And it's not fancy mathematics. It's just algebra. It's just sort of painful. But what you can find if you now solve for t and t prime, or solve for t and t prime with respect to t prime and x prime, is that you can extract these two time transformation formulas. Depending on the direction that what point of view you're looking at, whether the moving
relatively in the problem, whether the moving reference frame is going for positive x or negative, putting a different sign for the velocity. So the Lorentz transformations are really rather different. Transverse distance spatial transformations don't change anything, just like they don't in Galilean. You guys okay? Okay, so
if you look at the four transformations for the x coordinate, y coordinate, z coordinate, time, so that we call those the Lorentz transformations.
It is how space and time transform as you go from one reference frame to another. But we need to be able to transform other things. So what I'd like to do is to look at perhaps one of the simplest things you could imagine transforming, because it involves space and time, and that would be the velocity. So imagine that we have a coordinate system S, and we have another coordinate system S prime that is moving with respect to S with some velocity V along the x direction. And in addition, now let's say that we have some object out in three space that is moving with a velocity u, which is its three vector velocity. And let's say that that is the three vector velocity in reference frame S. So then the question is, what does u look like in S prime? So that would be what you mean when you say you want to do a transformation. So,
as we've seen with the space-time transformations, the dimension along the direction of motion is different from the dimension transversely. So we want to look at those differently here.
Let me start with the x component. So u of x in the prime coordinate is going to be defined as dx prime over dt prime for the object. And if we're given the information in S, then we know how to transform it into information in X prime if it's in the prime frame, if it's just position or time. And so if I use the Lorentz transformations that we already know, but I insert differentials appropriately. So if I move, I'm looking at dx prime, then we're talking about dx and dt in the other frame. And I divide that by the Lorentz transformed differential time. T prime is gamma t v over c squared x. dt prime is gamma dt minus v over c squared dx. Okay, so it's the same thing, it's just... So we just make use of the fact that we know how both the space and the time transform, and now we rearrange this a little bit by dividing through by dt, and we end up with gamma times dx over dt minus v over gamma times times 1 minus v over c squared dx over dt. But these quantities are what you mean when you have the velocity in the x direction in the S frame. So u of x prime is equal to gamma times u of x minus b over gamma times 1 minus b over c squared u in the x direction, or u of x minus b over 1 minus b over c squared ux. Interestingly, it doesn't actually have a gamma in it. Okay, so that's the x. So if we look in the y direction, that would be dy prime over dt prime. Dy prime is just equal to dy. Dt prime is equal to gamma dt minus b over c squared dx, divide through by dt, and you get dy over dt divided by gamma times 1 minus b over c squared dx over dt. This is a prime. All right, so we're looking for the velocity in the prime frame, knowing the velocity in the unprime frame. And what we see, if we look for the y component of it, it depends on the velocity in the y direction and the velocity in the x direction. It's a little bit weird.
So uy prime is equal to uy divided by gamma times 1 minus u in the x, b over c squared. And by analogy, because the derivation is the same in the z frame, you get that.
Okay? So velocity actually doesn't transform so simple.
In fact, it's a little bit ugly. So I want to go to a velocity that's a little cleaner relativistically in just a minute, but why don't we do an example with just the plain Lorentz transformations. Let us suppose that we have, again, two reference frames, S and S prime. And we'll put an asteroid at the origin of S. And we will have a rocket ship, which is traveling, and it's traveling, it basically is the S prime coordinate system, would be the reference frame of the rocket ship. And let's say that it's moving at 0.7 times the speed of light.
So if we calculate gamma is equal to 1 over 1 minus 0.7 squared, which is equal to 1.4. And what we'll say is that event 1 is that the rocket passes the asteroid. And this happens when time is zero in the S frame and time is zero in the S prime frame. We'll just define that to be the zero time for both frames. Then event two is that some sort of light beacon flashes at x equal 3 kilometers, t equal 5 microseconds, and of course this is in S. So then the question is, what does event 2 look like in S prime? In other words,
from the point of view of the rocket ship, when and where does the beacon flash? It flashed at 3 kilometers out along x in the positive direction at 5 microseconds after t equals zero in the asteroid frame. Okay?
So the position of event 2 in the prime frame is going to be equal to gamma times the position of event 2 in the unprime frame minus b times the time of event 2 in the unprime frame. Okay? So we can calculate that out. That's 1.4 times 3 minus 0.7 times 3 times 10 to the 5th times 5 times 10 to the minus 6. And when I calculate that out, I get 2.73 kilometers.
So maybe might not seem so crazy. The distance seems shorter. But that's where the position is that the light appears to.
So then the question is, what time does it appear to flash in the prime frame? So using Lorentz transformation, the time for event 2 is equal to gamma times t2 minus b over c squared times x2. Which, if I calculate this out, and if I did it correctly, it's equal to minus 2.8 microseconds.
Sees the beacon flash 2.8 microseconds before it passes the asteroid. In the other frame of reference, the beacon flashes however long, 5 microseconds after the rocket ship passes the asteroid. Does this bother you? Should it bother you? Okay, that should bother you. The time ordering of the events changed. And yes, I tweaked the numbers until I made sure that that happened. It doesn't always happen. If the passage of the rocket ship caused the signal to propagate that then caused the beacon to flash, so that there was a causal connection between those two events, I could never have tweaked the numbers to get a reversal in the time order. But if they're not causally connected, you can certainly get all sorts of weird things happen. And it doesn't matter. You can get complete shifts in the torque. Okay? A way to say it is
one of the things you'll commonly see when you talk about relativity is you say, okay, let's just consider one dimension for simplicity. And let us plot time this way and position that way. And let us say that let us set the value of light, the speed of light, to 1, if you want. So what that means is if I am at the origin and I send a light beam along the x direction, okay, then it will travel a certain distance x in a certain time. So it will travel, depending on the direction I send it, okay, it travels at the 45 degree line. If something is traveling slower than the speed of light, it goes less far in x in the same amount of time, so you would end up in this region. If something is traveling faster than the speed of light, then it goes farther in a given time than light does. So you'd be sort of in this region. And you can consider your past, if you will. Things that are here. A beam of light could have reached you before now. If they're far enough away, at the time you are right now, a beam of light would not have ever reached you before. This is called your light cone. And it constitutes the universe to which you can be causally connected. Not say you are causally connected, but there may be some event in the past that had nothing to do with how you are right now, whatever, but in principle it could be. So, let me see if I get it right. I believe you call events here space-like and events here time-like. What that means is if something is in your space-like cone, your light cone, that constitutes those things to which you could be causally connected, you'll never be able, if you have two events happening, then you can't shift the time order. But if they're over here, you could, and it makes a difference, or would make no difference. So,
I forget to what extent I'm going to drag you through this in the problem set, but I'll figure that out before I sign it. But you may do a little bit more with this, these so-called time-like and space-like events.
What I want to spend more time on, though, are sort of things that are a little more elegant relativistically than this crap.
If we think of velocity in terms of a normal velocity, its relativistic transformation is ugly and not so obvious. Okay? There are certainly instances where you will have to do this. Okay? You'll have to deal with these.
And they can be very important. There's a standard type of problem. I probably should have prepared an example for it.
Suppose you have two ships approaching each other at 0.6 times the speed of light, and one ship fires a missile that's going 0.8 times the speed of light in its reference frame. You know, what does it look like in the other reference frame? In Galilean, you've got something over the speed of light. And the way you have to do that problem is you have to do the velocity transformation, and that's what saves your butt and keeps it from violating the speed of light.
So I'll certainly give you something like that to play with, because they're a lot of fun. But what I want to spend some time on right now is sort of a more elegant velocity transformation. So what we've just looked at is the transformation of
the full velocity. But let's think about sort of a different type of problem. Suppose you were taking an airplane flight to Los Angeles, and what you were actually interested in was not what is your relativistic velocity transformation, but what you wanted to know was whether or not you were going to be hungry when you got to LA. And if you think about that for a moment, you don't want to just transform the full velocity. What you want to do is to transform the distance, but keep the time in your proper frame. Because it's your proper frame that determines whether you're going to be hungry or not when you land. Does that make sense? It's sort of a different velocity, if you want to think about it. It's sort of some strange velocity that's relevant for you.
So what I want to do is to define what's known as the proper velocity. And that's going to be equal to dx over d tau, where I will define tau as proper time. See, the thing about a proper time,
it's a little bit like you know, we've had time dilation. So if I have the average human lifetime in our reference frame, if you were to look at it from some other reference frame, we have our proper frame of reference, so we'll call it 75. If you look at it from some other reference frame, you'll now have to transform that. Okay? But the average lifetime really is what the average lifetime is in the proper frame of humans. Okay? So if you took humans and you had them in this other frame, you'd measure the same proper time in that frame. So the proper time itself is invariant. It doesn't transform. It's a special time.
So if we want to think of this flight to LA, then dx is sort of the time measured on the ground, or the distance, and d tau is sort of what's important for your stomach. That's your proper time. So if we look at the proper velocity in the x direction, that's dx over d tau. The proper time is a fixed time, but it does transform as you look at if you look at it from some other point of view. So this quantity will transform like the space, basically. So dt is equal to gamma d tau, where this is the proper time. So if we put that in, then we find that this is gamma times v in the x. So what we've constructed is dt. So if I transform d tau into dt by basically using this transformation, then you find that the proper velocity is equal to gamma times the velocity along that direction. The reason the proper velocity is very nice is because once you've got it, you've really only got one thing that transforms, which is the x. The problem with the velocity per se is you have to transform both the spatial part and the time part. So what we do is we construct the proper velocity where you have the spatial part and the time part now doesn't transform. So the whole thing transforms just like space. So you basically have constructed a quantity that should be able to transform using standard Lorentz transformations translated to space and velocity. In other words, instead of...
it should transform with the same transformation properties as the space one that we've already seen. Let's see if that makes sense. I should probably insert an example here, but I'll do that start class next time. But let me take an additional step or two. So,
you may wonder, why do you care for this simplicity of having the transformation be the same? And here's at least one nice reason why. Let's suppose that I have an object with a mass and a velocity in some reference frame, and another one with a mass and a velocity in its reference, and they collide. And so after the collision, I have some mc with a velocity c and some md with a velocity d. Let's suppose, in spite of my drawing, that it's all one-dimensional. The problem is we can write this down, we can write down a formula for momentum conservation in one reference frame. And if we have standard velocities here, and you look at the process from a different reference frame, momentum conservation doesn't seem to work. You have a very complicated expression for all these velocities.
It turns out that if, instead of writing it this way, we write that momentum is defined as mass times the proper velocity, then you'll find that momentum conservation holds. So long as you define the fourth component. Remember, velocity, we've only talked about three velocity, and in doing so, we only worried about the three dimensions of space and time sort of separately, and they only got mixed up a little in the actual transformation. But we know that for the space-time transformation, what gets mixed up are the three spatial dimensions and time. So if we want to talk about momentum, and then we know what we mean when we talk about three momentum, and we can define it like this so that it's a proper velocity, but it's still got three components. You've got a proper velocity in the x, the y, and the z. So if you're going to have a transformation that looks like that of space-time, there has to be some fourth component. And it turns out that if you define the proper velocity the way that we have, and you define momentum using the proper velocity, then you can find that momentum conservation will hold if you define the fourth component of the four vector, of the momentum vector, if you will, to be gamma times mass times c squared. So if you have that, then you find that fully three-dimensional momentum conservation holds. So what that means, as you've seen, we get space and time get sort of mixed up in a Lorentz transformation, and we call this sort of the space-time four vector, because it's sort of a four-component vector. And similarly, then, what I'm arguing is that we call this quantity is called the relativistic energy. And so if I call this relativistic energy, label it E, and put it in here as part of the four vector, what you find is that this set of quantities transform exactly in the same way as those quantities. So they're special. They're relativistically correct. And there's a bit of a mouthful in there, because just like space and time get mixed up when you do a transformation, now you have the exact same transformations, but instead of x, you would put momentum in the x, relativistic momentum in the x. And instead of time, you put in energy. So that means momentum and energy get mixed up in how you're looking at it from, what reference frame you're looking at it from. Now, if we define energy in this way, so does this make any sense?
In order to preserve momentum conservation in a relativistic world, you sort of need these definitions to be what they are. That gives you this proper relativistic transformation. And so there is something special about this energy, so let's look at it a little bit more.
We've defined the energy, relativistic energy, as mc squared over 1 minus b over c squared, square root of that quantity. If we do a Taylor series expansion of this, we get mc squared times 1 minus, well, let's do a Taylor series expansion of it, sorry. We Taylor expand that quantity, remember that would go as so that would be the standard Taylor series expansion. So what that would mean if I do the Taylor series expansion for this energy, I get the energy is equal to mc squared plus 1/2 mv squared plus higher order terms. I skipped a step, sorry. That's not very pretty. Terms in V over C, which is for smallish V, is very small. This you should recognize as just the kinetic energy. This term is what we call the rest energy. This was sort of the subject, well, it was the subject of his second paper on relativity in 1905.
What you find is that the energy that is relevant in relativity has a piece that you call out that you don't normally think about in Newtonian physics, which is you actually say that the object at rest has energy that's just tied up in its mass. The M here is not changeable. You will sometimes read treatments that talk about how something gets heavier and heavier as it goes closer to the speed of light. That's actually not true. That's unfortunate pedagogy. You can think of it that way in a sense because you have this gamma associated with the mass. So if you look at it from a different point of view, you can talk about the mass changing. But what I think is proper to think about in relativity is that the mass is fixed from reference frame to reference frame, but the total energy is something that increases as you get close to the speed of light. So this relativistic energy is growing with gamma, and but the rest energy of the object is a Lorentz invariant. It doesn't change, you go from the current to current. But you do get the kinetic energy that will have velocity to it. So this is actually something new now. You have the energy tied up in the actual mass. Or you can reverse that the other way. If I have a pot of water and I put it on the stove and I heat it up and I increase its energy, it turns out it also increases the current level.
All right, so we'll come back to this at the start of class next time, and we'll figure out why we've been talking about relativity in an electromagnetism course. Oh, crap. I'm sorry. Your exams are up here. I apologize.
just throw your things in there.